This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 28th of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, a fire in New Mexico threatens the Los Alamos nuclear research facility.
They're calling in all the forces on this one, bringing in both local firefighting teams and federal firefighting teams. And the governor of New Mexico has mobilized the National Guard to help fight it. So everybody recognizes that this is a serious, serious fire.
On Capitol Hill, an undocumented student and a Pulitzer Prize winner urge lawmakers to pass the DREAM Act. And the International Criminal Court prosecutor calls for Libyans to arrest Colonel Gaddafi. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Another 20 medical professionals in Bahrain were released from detention today, but their military trials are still ongoing. Another 14 remain in jail, accused by the state of supporting pro-democracy demonstrators. Human rights groups say they simply treated the wounded and that some are guilty only of speaking to the media. Many of those released say they were tortured into confessing to crimes they did not commit. Hundreds of people have been arrested in Bahrain. Some have already received life sentences. A spokesperson for the King of Saudi Arabia said today that beginning next week, they will pull out some of the 1,500 troops they deployed to Bahrain. He did not say how many. The International Monetary Fund confirmed its first female leader today, but it will still be led by a European. World financial leaders met in Washington, D.C. and confirmed France's finance minister. The U.S. formally supported Christine Lagarde today over Mexico's Augustin Carstens. Lagarde has been central to France's financial support of Greece, where lawmakers will take up controversial austerity measures this week. The drastic spending cuts are required by the IMF in return for loans. Hundreds of thousands of protesters swarmed through Athens today as a two-day general strike against the cuts began. The protests were largely peaceful, but small groups of rioters were met by large amounts of tear gas. In Brazil, a Sao Paulo judge has approved the country's second first gay marriage. FSRN's Deborah Pill explains.
Brazilian judge Fernando Henrique Pinto converted the civil union of two men into an official marriage yesterday, technically establishing the first gay marriage in the South American country. Hairdresser Sergio Kaufman Souza and tradesman Luiz André Morezzi became officially married after an eight-year-long relationship and from now on will use the same last name, Souza Morezzi. The decision also guarantees their rights in case one of them passes away. The couple will pick up their marriage certificate today at the registrar's office in the city of Jacareí. Today also marks the day that Brazilians celebrate gay pride. Even though Judge Pinto based his decision on provision of the country's constitution, the couple is concerned that the official marriage may be cancelled by yet another judge. Earlier this month, Judge Jerônimo Pedro Villas Boas legally cancelled what had been the first gay marriage in Goiás State. Deborah Pio, Free Speech Radio News, São Paulo.
Afghan officials issued an international arrest warrant today for the former head of the country's central bank. Abdul Qadir Fitrat fled to the United States and is currently in Virginia. Fitrat claims that he feared for his life after exposing hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud at the Kabul bank. Afghan authorities say Fitrat ran from charges he would have faced as a result of a recently completed investigation into the bank scandal. Kabul Bank is partially owned by relatives of the country's president and vice president. Afghan authorities say they will ask the U.S. to extradite the former finance chief. In the past 2 years, more than a quarter of a million everyday Afghans have fled their homes and villages, and according to a new report out today by Refugees International, nearly 100,000 have done so since the first of this year. The study is deeply critical of both Afghan and international security forces, saying that while they have taken steps to reduce civilian casualties, they have not gone nearly far enough to prevent forced internal displacement. Today is the last day that California Governor Jerry Brown can sign the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. The bill would give farm workers the right to unionize. Jesse Russell is with the Workers Independent News Service.
After making it through the legislature, the bill landed on the governor's desk June 16th, and there it has sat. If ratified, the legislation would streamline the process for farm workers to unionize and provide greater protections from intimidation. Proponents of the legislation say it's necessary to ensure that laws currently on the books are enforced, as it'll provide farm workers with an amplified voice when it comes to basic necessities in the field, such as shade, water, and training, to prevent heat stroke. It will give workers a voice for when dangerous pesticides are being used above suggested limits in the fields, giving consumers a new line of defense before a product comes to market. It will additionally add a way for workers to report discrimination and sexual harassment without risking retribution.
That report filed by Jesse Russell with Workers Independent News. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In the mountains of northern New Mexico, dozens of firefighters are battling to control a blaze in Las Conchas that's threatening the Los Alamos National Laboratory, the nuclear research facility where the world's first atomic bomb was developed. The fire has grown overnight to cover an area of more than 90 square miles, and most of the residents of Los Alamos, more than 10,000 people, have been evacuated from the town. Last night, a fire did start briefly on grounds belonging to the laboratory, which employs more than 9,000 people. The laboratory grounds cover 40 square miles and include 1,300 individual facilities. But so far, lab officials say radioactive materials stored on site are safe. Jay Coughlin is executive director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico. He's monitoring the fire. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
You have the latest information on this fire from the Forest Service. What are they saying about this fire and what it's going to do today and into tomorrow?
Nobody's making any hard and fast predictions about this fire. It's just too volatile. It's too fast and furious. The one thing it did do, it grew another 20,000 acres overnight. This is really an astonishing fire.
And it's already forced the Los Alamos laboratory to shut. How much of a threat is it now?
At the moment, it doesn't appear to be an immediate threat. And the fire has bumped up against the southwestern boundary of the lab. But conditions were a little bit more favorable last night in that the winds were coming from the east to the west, kind of blowing it away from the lab. The forecast states that the winds are supposed to come out of the southwest later today, which is actually the prevailing pattern. Now, in that case, that would push the fire onto the laboratory and onto the Los Alamos town site. But again, this is a very large, unpredictable, and dangerous fire.
You've been observing the firefighting efforts yourself. What sorts of protective measures are in place to stop the flames reaching the laboratory?
Well, we had a serious fire here in the year 2000, that 11 years ago. And since that time, the laboratory has taken some preventative measures, you know, clearing out trees and underbrush from sensitive facilities, cutting fire lanes, et cetera. And they're calling in all the forces on this one, bringing in both local firefighting teams and federal firefighting teams. And the governor of New Mexico has mobilized the National Guard to help fight it. So everybody recognizes that this is a serious, serious fire.
And what sorts of materials are held at this laboratory that could be dangerous?
Well, the short answer is lots of materials. Plutonium, highly enriched uranium, lots of nuclear weapons grade materials. Now, having said that, obviously these materials are not treated in a casual manner just for security purposes alone. So the weapons grade materials are, I do believe that they're highly secure in hardened vaults, et cetera, et cetera. The same cannot be said of, call it, waste materials. And, for example, one area of the laboratory holds some 20,000 barrels of plutonium-contaminated waste in fabric buildings. So these are not in hardened structures. Now, fortunately, that's on the other end of the laboratory from where the fire is now. Should we have a fire at where these 20,000 barrels are located, that could have severe consequences. But on the other hand, I do think the probability of that occurring is fortunately low.
Thousands of people have already been evacuated from the town of Los Alamos, but some are still there. In a worst-case scenario, if these winds change, could this laboratory be a danger to many people if the fire reaches it?
Oh, yes. Yes, clearly. And again, given the prevailing winds, there is a significant chance that that could occur, not only to the laboratory, but also to the town site. And evacuation is mandatory, began to be mandatory yesterday for both the lab and the town site. You know, it's going to be a ghost town for right now, but at least virtually all people should be out of harm's way.
I'm also wondering whether they've evacuated all employees and staff. Is there anyone actually at the laboratory now?
Oh, yes, so-called essential people. And I'm not denigrating when I say so-called. That's what they call it. And indeed, there are essential personnel, both for security purposes. There's lots of materials that have to be guarded. They tend to keep that a little bit classified. I would assume that security personnel are in the couple of hundreds, and the same is true of firefighting personnel.
Jay Coughlin, Executive Director of Nuclear Watch New Mexico, thanks very much for your time.
And thank you.
International Criminal Court Prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo called for Libyan authorities to arrest leader Muammar Gaddafi following warrants issued for him, his son, and the head of military intelligence. Speaking today in The Hague, Ocampo said Libya has the primary responsibility to implement the arrest warrants.
Let me be clear. International forces operating under UN Security Council Resolution 1973 have no specific mandate to implement arrest warrant, and the court is not asking international forces for that. Of course, more than ever, there is an urgent need for negotiations. But negotiations have to respect UN Security Council Resolution 1970 to do justice in Libya, and the core decision that Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, and al-Sanusi should be arrested.
The warrants cover charges of murder and persecution. Following concerns from human rights groups who questioned whether there was evidence Gaddafi's forces sexually assaulted civilians, Ocampo said they're continuing to investigate allegations of rape. Rebels and residents in Misrata celebrated the arrest warrants in addition to calling for more help from NATO. But critics, including South African President Jacob Zuma, say the ICC's move undermined efforts by the African Union to find a political solution to end the three-month-long war. Back in Washington, U.S. lawmakers continue to debate the U.S. role in the Libyan conflict. Senators are considering a joint resolution sponsored by Republican John McCain and Democrat John Kerry that would authorize continued U.S. involvement in the NATO bombing campaign. Kerry spoke this morning at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing.
A Senate resolution authorizing the limited use of force in Libya will, I think, show the world, in particular Muammar Gaddafi, at a time when most people make a judgment that the noose is tightening, the vice is squeezing, the opposition is advancing, the regime is under enormous pressure, that Congress and the President are committed to this critical endeavor.
Kerry's resolution is currently being reviewed in committee. You're listening to FSRN. Across the U.S., the immigration debate is coming to a head. A federal judge in Atlanta blocked portions of Georgia's new immigration law earlier this week, and South Carolina has become the latest state to approve harsh enforcement measures. It too expects legal challenges. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate Immigration Subcommittee held its first ever hearing on the DREAM Act, legislation that would create a path to citizenship for undocumented youth who attend college or serve in the military. Alice Olstein reports.
Amber was brought to the U.S. from Mexico when she was just 3 years old and grew up in Fayetteville, Arkansas. She and 15 classmates took a bus to Washington, D.C. to attend Tuesday morning's hearing on the DREAM Act. For her and many others in the room, the issue is personal.
It means my future because I am undocumented. And if after college and after all the money I'm going to have to pay, including out-of-state tuition because of the state I live in, I want to know that I'll have the opportunity to contribute back to the country.
Dressed in her maroon high school cap and gown, she said she wanted senators to put her face on what has become a politicized and polarized issue.
Sometimes they say, oh, those illegal immigrants and stuff like that. We are students, and you know, and when they put their face to it and they see us in our caps and gowns, they realize that it's a more personal issue than what they're making it.
Inspired by DREAM Act students like Amber, who publicly came out as undocumented, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jose Antonio Vargas put his career on the line by revealing that he'd been working for major news outlets without papers. He says his frustration with Congress motivated him to leave reporting and fight for the DREAM Act's passage.
I mean, this may seem just like some sort of a bill or some sort of a legislation, but we're dealing with people's lives. We're dealing with their lives. And you can't play football with that. And that's what we've been doing for 10 years on this specific legislation, and it needs to stop.
Last December, the Senate failed to advance the DREAM Act by just 5 votes. Senate Democrats reintroduced it in May, but it will face an uphill battle. At the hearing, Republican Senator John Conrad of Texas said he supports the bill in theory, but has too many economic and legal concerns to commit his vote. The DREAM Act does enjoy strong administration backing. During the hearing, Education Secretary Arne Duncan gave the two main reasons he supports the legislation.
First, it's an issue of fairness. Thousands of young people have worked hard, but they're being denied the chance to build a better future for themselves and to contribute their skills, talents, and creativity to our country. Second, it's an issue of economic prosperity. By offering these young people the chance to earn a college degree, we're helping them establish their own economic security. And in the process, they will help sustain America's economic competitiveness into the future.
Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano and Undersecretary of Defense Clifford Stanley also testified in support of the bill. They cited the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimate that the DREAM Act would reduce the deficit by $1.4 billion over a decade, as the millions of new legal workers would pay more taxes and pump money into the economy through direct spending. Though the bill has failed many times since it was first introduced in 2001, Amber and her fellow Dreamers say they remain hopeful.
I think we've made a lot of progress in the position and minds of the senators and the representatives, because I feel like before it was a complete no, and now it's more open to conversation, which we're really happy.
Journalist Jose Antonio Vargas says in his position, optimism is the only option.
I don't think you can be pessimistic. You know, if I were pessimistic, I would have given up a long time ago. And I think these kids that you just saw, the students in that room, would have given up a long time ago. You know, America is about optimism, and we're optimists.
Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin, who chaired the hearing, said he's also committed to working towards comprehensive immigration reform, but he wants to get the DREAM Act passed first. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Investigators in Nevada continue their search into the causes behind the deadly tractor-trailer crash into an Amtrak train. Both the truck driver and the trucking company had been previously cited for numerous safety violations. Safety is also part of the debate about a U.S.-Mexico trucking program, originally introduced in 2007 by former President George Bush, but defunded in 2009. In response, Mexican officials accused the U.S. of violating the NAFTA treaty and retaliated by placing an annual $2.4 billion tariff on U.S. goods. That would all change under the new plan. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
Fred McLucky, legislative director for the Teamsters, says that program comes at the worst possible time for U.S. workers who are facing staggering unemployment rates.
They're implementing a program that's going to take away more American truck driving jobs and probably affect a significant amount of warehousing jobs along the border.
The renewed trucking program would put an end to a ban on hauling freight beyond the 20-mile restriction zone, allowing U.S. and Mexican trucks to go back and forth across the border. In order to qualify, Mexican truckers would have to comply with strict new safety standards. They must carry electronic onboard recorders in their vehicles. This would ensure that they only make cross-border runs and not longer distance domestic trips. Mexican carriers would also be limited to a certain number of hours they can drive a day. In return, Mexican officials will lift the $2.4 billion in annual tariffs. The Teamsters argues there is no way the proposed plan can adequately enforce the safety measures.
The program looks good on paper, but in reality, we don't think that they have the resources to properly perform the inspections and enforce our laws.
However, a report by the Congressional Research Service counters that assertion. According to the 2010 study, Mexican trucks and drivers have equivalent and possibly better safety records than U.S. trucks and drivers. Dan Labatz is editor of Mexican Labor Notes and Analysis.
There are no doubt a lot of problems with the Mexican government, and there are no doubt some unsafe trucks. But a lot of times these arguments were kind of covered also with a kind of veneer of racist attitudes towards both Mexican trucking companies and Mexican drivers.
Some U.S. industries welcome the program because of the agreement to eliminate Mexican tariffs. Dave Warner of the National Pork Producers Council says his industry sold nearly 1 billion pounds of pork to Mexico last year alone.
We just need to get that tariff off. I mean, it's a simple fix.
But not all farmers would benefit. Chris Cepeda-Millen is a Ph.D. candidate in the Department of Government at Cornell University. Looking back, he says that the measure has had a disastrous impact on small Mexican farmers ever since NAFTA allowed U.S. subsidized goods into Mexican markets 17 years ago.
We saw a flood in increasing U.S. subsidies, which also devastated the already fragile small farming in Mexico, right? So one estimate was that you had about 600 farmers a day since 1994 being displaced, of about 200,000 a year.
As a result, some 1.75 million people left Mexico, according to a 2003 study by the International Forum on Global Trade, a group that focuses on globalization issues. Aside from displacing Mexican farmers, others say the trucking program will lead to higher unemployment in the U.S. Todd Spencer is executive vice president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, representing 160,000 small business and independent truck drivers. He says that under the plan, large U.S. trucking companies might replace U.S. workers with Mexican truckers, who earn an average of 60% less than their U.S. counterparts.
Instead of outsourcing jobs and manufacturing, we're insourcing more labor.
He also says that the program will not benefit Mexican carriers working for U.S. companies in their homeland. Spencer says that's because large U.S. carriers in Mexico already pay Mexican truckers low wages.
Our small business counterparts in Mexico are victimized by these same economic practices now.
Spencer is also concerned that U.S. warehouse and freight loading companies would migrate south, affecting thousands of U.S. employees. Congress is expected to vote on the trucking program sometime this summer. Leilani Albano, Free Speech Radio News, Los Angeles.
1 year ago this week, police in Toronto arrested more than 1,000 people during the G20, some of them violently. Ontario's ombudsman, André Marin, released a report on the mass crackdown on demonstrators, which he called the most massive compromise of civil liberties in Canadian history. The Real News Network's Paul Jay spoke to Marin about his investigation and report.
What did your investigation find that led you to make such a statement?
Well, essentially, the Toronto Police Services had requested of the Ministry of the Attorney General the passage of a regulation which had the effect of reviving a 1939 piece of legislation that allowed police, or gave the police, extravagant new powers of arrest and detention, powers which in my opinion, were likely illegal and unconstitutional. And so all the detentions that took place and the arrests that took place that day were an abuse of power. And the problem was that this regulation, which was adopted of dubious legality, was adopted secretly. It was never advertised. It wasn't promulgated publicly. The City of Toronto went to a great deal of effort to advertise the street closures and that kind of thing, but they never talked about the new regulation. The provincial government did talk about this new regulation, and so citizens groups who were lawful protesters, demonstrators that weekend, were unable to abide by the law because it was secret, and that is again wrong as well.
The Public Works Protection Act allows, if you're protecting a public building, for anyone approaching that building to be asked for identification, to be searched. And as you point out in your report, they can't simply just say, oh, I don't want to go there and walk away. Mm-hmm. You have to comply, and which is a violation of any normal charter rights, because you don't have to normally provide identification in Canada unless there's probable cause. So how did this extend so far past the building when supposedly this is supposed to be around this narrow perimeter?
The problem is when you keep a regulation secret, you don't educate people. That also includes authorities. And that's why the chief of Toronto Police, for example, is talking about a 5-meter rule. The 5-meter rule didn't exist. There's no such thing as a 5-meter rule. So this actual regulation, which was kept secret, was misunderstood by authorities as well as protesters and members of the public. And that was part of the problem. Now, in Canadian law, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms protects against arbitrary arrests and detentions. And when you're stopped by 2, 3, 4 police officers, you're required to produce identification under legislation. That is a detention. And so some people will say, well, there's only a handful that were actually arrested under this regulation. At first, I remind your viewers that the Toronto Police had said no one had been arrested. Then it became, well, maybe a few.
But, and then it became two, and then one, it turned out they lost the paperwork.
That's correct. And now, but however, hundreds, if not thousands, were illegally detained. You have a right to walk through a public area in Canada without being required to stop and produce identification.
And once you're forced to produce ID, it's a detention.
It's a detention. And our Constitution provides us protection against that. And that, of course, is why the regulation, in my view, wasn't published.
And one of the more bizarre pieces of this legislation is that it's up to a police, an officer of the peace, or anyone appointed as an officer of the peace under this legislation, to define the space around the public building. I mean, they could define the whole country if they wanted to. And I know, and it even says that if it goes to court, the assertion by the peace officer of what he defined as the public space can't even be contested in court. It's a bizarre piece of legislation.
The legislation itself has a very wide definition for public works. It's any, you know, it would include highways and courthouses, any public buildings. And what happened during the G20 is because of the regulation extended the perimeter of what was considered a public works, because in 1939, the way the city of Toronto was designed is very different from 2010. And so this regulation had to provide for the extension of public works to cover areas that were not covered in 1939. So give it even more breadth than before. And so that's why we recommended that the government do away with this piece of legislation. And if ever they do change the rules of the game, they advertise what they've changed. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that one of the reasons why this regulation was kept secret is because of the fear of authorities that civil liberties organizations and others would challenge it in court.
Prior to the event.
That's right. And that's not a good reason to not publicize new laws.
That was the Ombudsman for Ontario, Canada, André Marin, speaking to the Real News Network's Paul Jay. To hear the full interview and for more on the G20 crackdown, go to therealnews.com. And that's the program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments at fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.